morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Day 2 of Infection Prevention 2009. As you know, as part of conference this year, we're celebrating 50 years of infection prevention. And in recognition of this milestone, the IPS Board and Scientific Programme Committee proposed a new inaugural lecture named after the first infection control nurse, Miss E.M. Cottrell. Our first session this morning is being broadcast via Weber training teleclasses to colleagues in the UK and around the globe. Welcome to that audience, and thank you to Virox Technologies and Johnson Diversey for their sponsorship of this teleclass. We're delighted to welcome Professor Robert Pratt to deliver the inaugural E.M. Cottrell Lecture. Robert is a past president of the Infection Control Nurses Association and is currently Professor of Nursing and Director of the Richard Wells Research Centre at Thames Valley University. He is also the Director of the Department of Health Healthcare Associated Infections Research Network and is a member of the Department's Independent Advisory Committee on Antimicrobial Resistance and Healthcare Associated Infection. I'm delighted to welcome Robert to deliver his presentation, The Pursuit of Excellence During a Global Pandemic. Thank you, Robert. Thank you.
Thank you, Heather, and good morning, colleagues. I'm honoured to present this inaugural lecture and to have the opportunity to briefly review with you what we as healthcare professionals have learned from our experience of past pandemics of infectious diseases. We are now witnessing the evolution of the first pandemic of the 21st century, and it's having a galvanizing effect on every person and every agency responsible for healthcare. Well-rehearsed pandemic preparedness strategies are now being rolled out to ensure the provision of effective healthcare during a potentially turbulent period in which the infrastructures of both the National Health Service and civil society may be tested and stressed. During this period, all practitioners need to be confident that they can play their part in ensuring the provision of quality care to patients while at the same time protecting themselves, each others, and their patients. Pandemics are transformational. Nothing is really ever the same after they've come and gone, and no one yet knows the full impact and consequences that the current global influenza pandemic will have on our country and our world. As we now prepare to engage the second wave of this pandemic, the need for confidence, courage, and excellence in infection prevention practice has never been greater. Pandemics are epidemics that occur in the same time frame in a wide geographical area, such as a region, or in the case of the three events considered in this presentation, global pandemics. They are seeded by microorganisms that have either mutated or recombined to form new variants, or by the introduction of newly emerging or re-emerging pathogens which populations will not have acquired any previous immunity to. These new pathogens often emerge as a result of zoonosis, humans becoming infected with microorganisms normally only found in other vertebrate animals. Successful pandemics need to be able to infect people and to be efficiently transmissible from person to person and then spread widely. Pandemic infections also need to cause significant clinical illness in a high proportion of those infected. Because of their sudden emergence, speed, power, and impact, pandemics are among the most frightening and severe threats to public health. What is it, then, that we can learn from these events about our healthcare institutions, our organizations, our practice, and ourselves? This is important because we need that insight in order to continue to build and test a high-quality, clinically effective infection prevention service, and absolutely nothing will more rigorously test the quality of that service than the advent of pandemic disease. Through a consideration of three pandemic vignettes, this presentation is designed to stimulate an exploration of excellence, what it is, why we covet it, and how we develop it at both an individual and organizational level. These vignettes further provide an opportunity to learn from the experiences of those practitioners and policymakers who confronted past pandemics and observe how their decisions and actions often redefined infection prevention and control practice as they strive to protect their patients and their community. Reflecting on these experiences and learning from our own moments of hesitation, errors, and the mistakes of others, but at the same time witnessing continuous enhancements in practice that have resulted from our often brilliant flashes of insight and discovery, we continue to create and perpetuate a professional practice memory with established and enduring points of excellence that can often serve to guide current and future policy and practice. It is these points of excellence that I want to draw out from these vignettes. So the first story. Well, this is a story familiar to many of you in this room. It's a global pandemic that appeared 60 years ago, the consequences of which, both good and bad, impact us on still today. This is a very brief account of the emergence of a drug-resistant strain of Staphylococcus aureus that caused this global pandemic in the 1950s and early 1960s. In large proportions of healthy human populations throughout the world, Staph aureus commonly colonizes, of course, the surface of the skin, especially the inside of the nose, but also other areas such as the throat and the perineum, etc. Globally, almost one out of three persons is regularly colonized by this common potential pathogen, which can cause a variety of minor skin infections and sometimes more serious invasive disease, such as surgical site infections, pneumonia, and bloodstream infections. During infection, this gram-positive bacterium produces multiple toxins, which are associated with a variety of diseases, ranging from brief self-limited illnesses to more serious conditions, such as necrotic skin and lung infections and toxic shock syndrome. When penicillin became available in the 1940s, it was very successfully used to treat these serious staphylococcal infections. However, during the 1950s, a virulent penicillin-resistant strain of Staph aureus, known as Phage-8081, emerged in Australia and Canada and then spread with pandemic force throughout hospitals and communities in many countries, causing serious skin lesions, sepsis, and pneumonia, especially in children. We now know that this strain produces Pantin-Valentine leukocidin, a PVL, a dangerous cytotoxin that destroys white blood cells and additionally is associated with increased virulence and often life-threatening invasive disease. The pandemic was eventually brought under control during the 1960s by the use of a new group of antibiotics, meticillin and its derivatives. However, resistance to these agents quickly developed after they were introduced, and MRSA emerged to become one of the most significant microbial causes of hospital-acquired infections throughout the world. A chilling postscript to the pandemic is that descendants of this strain reemerged as a new clone in the 1990s, known as community-acquired MRSA. These strains are genetically distinguishable from hospital-associated MRSA, and unlike those strains, community strains commonly produce the PVL cytotoxin. Initially identified in Australia and later in the United States and Europe, these strains infected otherwise healthy individuals in communities who were without any health care risks, such as recent hospitalizations, medical interventions, or prolonged antimicrobial therapy. In the U.S., PVL-producing and community-associated MRS strains have emerged as a major public health problem, and one strain in particular, known as USA 300, is now spreading in hospitals. Well, what then is that we can learn from the experience of this pandemic? Firstly, I think, is the fact that over many years, our determination to reduce the threat from MRSA has led to multiple national and local infection prevention and control initiatives. The success of these, both individually and collectively, have seen MRSA rates plummet in NHS hospitals, and it's starting to feel for the first time in a long time that we're on the verge of controlling this infection and significantly reducing its negative impact on patient safety. The second lesson that can be learned from this experience is that these initiatives did not come about by accident. Rather, they happened because of intense and enduring public, professional, and political commitment, driven and led by infection control champions, those heroes and heroines who are changing the world of clinical practice by minimizing the risk of infection during episodes of health care. The use of the term hero seems at first glance a bit strong, perhaps somewhat over the top. But what is a hero? How do we recognize and define one? We've all known heroes, I'm sure of that. In my life, I've seen heroes. In a far distant moment in my own life, I benefited from the actions of heroes. I always wanted to be a hero. I always admired heroes, and I'm sure that applies to many of you. But the intrinsic qualities that propelled them to heroism is often complex and elusive. Some heroes are obvious. The actions are so distinguished by raw courage and overwhelming fortitude that their heroism is apparent to all. As he rescued his fellow soldiers in Iraq, the courage of Lance Corporal Johnson Bihari, the youngest living recipient of the Victoria Cross, was so sharp, so driven, so intense that anyone would recognize his bravery as true heroism. However, sometimes that courage and fortitude is less reactive, but more subtle, more persistent, but equally brave. Unlike Corporal Bihari, living and reacting in his moment, the whole life of Florence Nightingale, this exceptional woman who founded professional nursing 150 years ago, was a life of constant low-key heroism, whether overseas in the field with the British Army or at home engaging in many causes and battles at the highest political levels. Well, back to our story then of this first epidemic populated by, amongst other things, these heroes. The local heroes that were involved in the West Country of England, one of these, the eponymous hero of this lecture, was appointed as the first infection control nurse in South Devon 50 years ago. And from that initiative, it can be argued that the age of modern infection control nursing in England had begun. Her story is brief, but the impact of her appointment can be felt today. It can be felt today in our hospitals. It can be felt today in this Infection Prevention Society and at our conference here this morning. Like most hospitals in the UK during the late 50s, Torbay Hospital in the West Country was experiencing serious outbreaks of infection in both hospital staff and postoperative patients. A staphylococcal survey confirmed a widely disseminated Staph aureus infection in surgical services, and virtually all nursing, virtually almost 100% of nursing and domestic staff were domestic carriers, were nasal carriers of Staph aureus. It was also recognized that current measures for preventing and controlling this outbreak were ineffective, that surveillance mechanisms were unreliable, and that investigations into factors and clinical practices associated with cross-infection were not systematically identifying the underlying causes that were perpetuating the hospital epidemic. Consequently, a new strategy was developed. It was developed by the local heroes, which is the matron, the hospital pathologist, and the members of the Infection Control Committee who waged great battles over this, and a central element of their strategy was one of those flashes of brilliance that became transformational. In this case, the appointment of a senior theater sister, Ms. E.M. Cottrell, as the hospital's infection control sister, the first such appointment of its kind in this country. This became the third point of excellence demonstrated in the story, and that is the critical importance of vision. Many of you will recognize this, perhaps, as the elements of your own job description, but Sister Cottrell's terms of reference embraced hospital epidemiology, surveillance, in-service education, clinical supervision of aseptic techniques, and research. Her responsibilities were extended to cover surrounding cottage hospitals, and by the end of 1961, the epidemic at Torbay Hospital was brought under control, in no small part thanks to the major contribution made by Sister Cottrell. Looking back, it's clear that besides Sister Cottrell, there were other heroes, which I've already mentioned, such as the matron. However, none of these, including Sister Cottrell, could have guessed at the long-term ramification of her appointment. Learning from the experience at Torbay Hospital, the neighboring Royal Devon and Exeter Hospital quickly appointed their own infection control sister. And within a decade, 41 UK infection control nurses, meeting in 1970 at the University of Bristol, formed the Infection Control Nurses Association. For almost four decades, the members of this association throughout the UK and the Republic of Ireland have pursued excellence within the field of infection prevention and control. Successive chairpersons, from Henry Street, the association's first chairperson in 1970, to Martin Kiernan, today's president of our society, all provided an unequaled source of expertise and national leadership in this field. The influence and impact of all the efforts, of all their efforts, of all the efforts of our members over the last 40 years is substantial, and that history is yet to be fully articulated. But when it is, you will see that the everyday heroes in this saga are you, our members, and those who support you. So the point of excellence arising from this vignette is that a carefully calculated decision by a committee in the West Country of England a half a century ago generated a cadre of commitment and excellence that self-propelled itself into inarguably the most influential body of expertise in prevention and in in infection prevention and control in Europe. Well, during that same period, while all that was happening, there were other pandemics in the 50s and the 60s. Not least of all, the last pandemic of the last major pandemic of polio in the early 1950s, and then influenza pandemics in the 1950s and 60s. And as the 1960s came to a close, little did anyone then suspect that a new virus had emerged and was silently spreading throughout the world. Having a long incubation period, it would be years before anyone realized what had happened to us. This is a story that is well known to you. I'm going to go through this story very briefly because of that, but just to remind you of some salient points here. You'll recall that this pandemic slowly evolved in sub-Saharan Africa, then North America and Europe during the 1960s and the 1970s. However, it wasn't until 1980 that physicians in the U.S. and Europe identified a new clinical syndrome of opportunistic infection secondary to a progressive immunodeficiency due to an unknown cause. Well, we know that cause today. In 1981, this new disease, soon to be named the Acquired Immunodeficiency Syndrome, or AIDS, formally introduced itself to the human race. Clusters of patients with this new syndrome in Los Angeles and in New York City were reported that year, as were cases being identified in Europe here in England. By the end of 1981, less than 1,000 patients had been identified with this new syndrome. And here we are 29 years later, and look what's happened. We've gone to less than 1,000 patients being identified at the beginning of this pandemic to the number of people who are estimated living with HIV is about 33 million. Add to that the total number of deaths from this condition is 25 to 30 million. So we're talking about 65 to 70 million people, from less than 1,000 to 25 to 30 million people. There were, in that year alone, in 2007, there were almost 3 million new infections, and I can just bring it up here. The total deaths they're hidden. We had to change the slides here, but the total deaths are about 3 million. There they are. The death rate's about 2 million, rather. Okay. over 7,400 new HIV infections are reported every day. Most of these are in low- and middle-income countries. They're in Africa. They're in sub-Saharan Africa and now starting to creep up dramatically in the South Pacific Basin, an area of the world where most of the human population resides. Of these 7,400 new infections, that means that there'll be 308 persons who will be infected every hour. So that's about 225 patients will be infected by the time I started speaking here to the time I finish. Most of these infections throughout the world are in children, are in adults aged between 15 and older. Almost 50% of these are women. And, of course, there are significant numbers of children who are infected and living with this condition. As more and more women become infected, then, of course, more and more of their children will become infected. And you can see here the incidence of children living with this condition. About 2 million children in that year under the age of 15 who were living with that condition, about a third of a million new infections each year in children, and just under a third of a million are dead. Or died that year. If the father becomes infected and infects the mother, and then the mother has three children, on average, one of those three children will become infected as a result of mother-to-child transmission. The father will die, the mother will die, and in most parts of the world, certainly that child will die. That leaves two children uninfected, but orphaned as a result of the AIDS-related deaths of their parents. Well, this is such a serious story that is just unfolding here, and that is the number of AIDS orphans. Just take a look at this. 12 million AIDS orphans in 2007 were estimated in sub-Saharan Africa alone. Here in the UK, we had in 2007 just under 80,000 adults living with HIV/AIDS. We had an annual incidence of just under 8,000, and that's remained pretty stable for the last few years. I would draw your attention to the curves here. The orange line here is the number of the number of patients with an HIV diagnosis, and you can see it shows a continuing trend to increase. And if we draw that over to where we are now, that has been sustained and is increasing. Most of the increase is in heterosexual men and women. The blue line is AIDS diagnosis, and you see that has gone down. An AIDS diagnosis is the end stage, of course, HIV infection. And then the death rate has also gone down. So here we are in this favorable position in this country, even though the total number of people living with HIV is increasing. Serious illness and death have been at least postponed. In most other parts of the world, these lines would be in congruence. All the lines would follow each other. Fortunately not here. It's sort of a really interesting point here. Of the 77,400 people estimated to be living with HIV/AIDS in this country, a breakdown of some of them down to 73,000, a little bit more, 28% of them are unaware of their infection. Well, what is the cause of all this human virus? It is emerging, this human suffering. It is an emerging virus, of course, and you're all familiar with the virus. There are two types, two major serotypes, human HIV-1 and HIV-2. HIV-1 is the dominant AIDS-causing virus in the world. Where did it come from? It is a classic example of a zoonotic infection that emerged from non-human primates to infect man. It's not unusual that it can infect and be successful in the human species. After all, the genetic sequencing of these two species is very similar. The virus in non-human primates is referred to as simian immunodeficiency virus, SIV, and SIV is more similar to HIV-1 and HIV-2 than HIV-1 and HIV-2 are similar to each other. So there's definite proof of this zoonotic emergence. Everyone here knows, of course, how this virus is being transmitted from person to person. 88% of people who are infected with this virus become infected as a result of sexual exposure. The next most common way the virus is transmitted throughout the world is mother-to-child transmission. Very rare in this country, very common in many other countries. Injecting drug use, of course, is a classic way of transmitting any blood-borne virus. And then healthcare practices and techniques are implicated in healthcare workers transmitting the infection to patients and patients transmitting the infection to healthcare workers. Very rare in our part of the world. Who knows in the resource-poor regions of the world. Well, some points of excellence have emerged from our experience of this pandemic. And that is that emerging from all this tragedy came a new concept in infection control. And much of that started right here in the UK. It became clear that we had to have enhanced mechanisms in place to protect nurses and other healthcare providers from exposure to blood and body fluids from patients who we knew were infected with this virus or we suspected they could have been infected. And this became known as blood and body fluid precaution. It quickly dawned, though, like almost instantaneously, that we could not segregate patients like that. We could not determine who was infected and who was not infected. There still is not any reliable test that can prove to anyone that somebody is not infected. So consequently, it became clear that we had to apply blood and body fluid precautions universally to all patients all the time. Coming out of the States was an elaboration of this with body substance isolation, where in addition to blood and body fluids, there were also concern about moist mucous membrane, etc. All that has now been wrapped up into the standard infection prevention and control principles and precautions that are operational in this country and in most countries in this part of the world. Another point of excellence is that the early fears of contagion quickly receded. This was very distressing in the first couple years of our experience with this pandemic. There were incidents of refusals to care, gross discrimination, and quite frankly, cruelty. And all that quickly passed, again, because not least of all, some of the champions who were active, some of the heroes who were active in this field. And then very important is a powerful lobby of patients groups emerged, and they were vociferous, sometimes aggressive, but they were essential in bringing about a necessary change, and how grateful we are to them. heroes of this particular pandemic, just two, there's so many, and I suspect many of the heroes of this pandemic are sitting in this room this morning. But two, I just want to always remember is Richard Wells from the Royal College of Nursing, nurse advisor, the oncology nurse advisor, who kept calming everything down in the early part of this pandemic, reassuring people what was right, what was wrong, what was safe, what was not safe. He had immense authority, and his contribution is just has been incredible. And then on an international stage is, of course, the wonderful Professor Jonathan Mann, who he and his wife died, unfortunately, in a plane crash coming out of Montreal in Canada following the International AIDS Conference. But he was an elegant, articulate, an inspiring individual. You had 5 minutes with him, and you were converted to dedicating the rest of your life to making life better for people living with HIV disease. Both of them are now sorely missed. Finally, I want to come on to the third vignette. And this I'm not going to spend a lot of time on. Most of you have been bombarded. There's been a pandemic of information about this condition. But there are just a few things I want to point out to you, because in a way the United Kingdom has a major leadership role globally in how they have prepared for this. The preparations have been in place for years and years and years, and they're now being tested and found to be a really first class. So just a few things here about influenza viruses. So forgive me if you all know this. But as you know, there are three viruses that can infect humans. Influenza virus A, B, and C. We don't have to worry about C. It causes the common cold, one of the causes of the common cold, especially in children. It doesn't cause influenza as we know it. Influenza viruses A and B are involved in causing winter flu, the seasonal a pandemic that happens every year. But only influenza A virus can cause pandemics. It is the real daddy of the viruses. Now, the virus has, as much as I would like to go into the biological characteristics of this virus, I'll spare you that. But there are a couple of things you need to know. Otherwise, when people go around talking about H1N1, you have no idea what the H and the N stand for. So I just want to point out it really is very simple. The virus reminds me a little bit of its outside, reminds me a little bit of HIV. It has the spikes sticking out of it that whirls around. As the virus whirls around, the spikes form attachments to cells. You will recall that viruses are not cells. They're simply parasites. They can't replicate by themselves. Like any parasite, they must invade a cell and then steal the chemistry of that cell in order to replicate. So there are only two, and there's hemagglutinin, and there are 16 subtypes. When we are talking about the subtypes, the hemagglutinin subtypes, we just call H1, H2, H3, on up to 16. Only a few of the early ones, H1 to H3, can cause a human disease. The next one is neuraminidase, and there are 9 subtypes, so we just call that N1, N2, etc. So that will make sense in just a few minutes with the next slide I'm going to tell you. The other thing I want to bring to your attention is the genome of this virus. Not being a cell, it doesn't, of course, have a nucleus, but it collects its nucleic acid, the essence of life itself. It collects its nucleic acid within a core. We're used to seeing this, you know, if you draw pictures of viruses, you usually put a little squiggly line to show a little piece of nucleic acid, either RNA or DNA, never both. But here we have a segmented genome. There are 8 segments, and each of these segments contain one gene. A couple of the segments contain 2 genes. And the genes, of course, encode proteins that make new viruses. So you only need one gene on one segment to mutate, and then the virus that comes out, because when that gene sends the instructions out to build the new virus, it's going to be faulty. And so that means there is going to be a slow change because these viruses replicate at an astounding rate, and so they're error-prone. And so we're going to have viruses in which there's a little fault here that antibodies will no longer be able to attach to them because it turns out to be a new strain. I'll come back to the genome in just a minute, but that segmentation is sinister in the extreme, as I'll demonstrate to you in just 2 seconds. So here we have then why we have seasonal variations in the influenza viruses, and also while we have pandemics. So here we have, this is where the hemagglutinin has just slowly over time acquired new characteristics, and it changes slightly. So the strain just gently drifts along, keep changing, and so within a year or two, the strain is different here, and that is a characteristic of all influenza A viruses, this antigenic drift, which involves minor mutation. But every once in a while, there's a major, an abrupt change, and this is an antigenic shift. And when this happens, the product of that shift can take your breath away, literally. The two ways that the outcome will end up in a pandemic, one is where, I forgot to mention, all the influenza viruses, of which there are legion, all of them, the reservoir for those influenza viruses are aquatic birds, waterfowl, things like flocks of wild ducks and geese, etc. So say we have a virus in a bird that directly infects a human being, like H5N1, right? And that human being then has a new virus, doesn't have to do anything else, doesn't have to worry about changing its genetic composition. It's there. That person is infected with a new species of virus, a new strain that we don't have any immunity to, and away the story goes. Another way it happens is that, say it's me and I'm infected with a routine influenza virus, and then I get infected with another virus, say from a pig or from a bird. And then inside, when the virus goes inside a cell, it uncoats. It loses all its packaging. The only thing that gets inside the cell is the genome, those segments of RNA. And so there they are, the segments of RNA like this, like a little pot of spaghetti floating around inside a cell, and in come another one floating around, and they then start mixing together, and then we have something popping out that's called a reassorted a virus, and that's what we're dealing with today. Just want to tell you our experience very briefly of pandemics of influenza. They started occurring just going back the last 100 or so years. We had, I hope you can see all this, it's a little bit dark, but we had I tell you how programmed I am. I'm using the pointer to point to what's in front of me instead of... at any rate, so we have the... this was the Russian influenza pandemic that occurred in the 1880s, H2N2. And then coming along with the old Hong Kong influenza virus. This is a little bit curious to us. This is H3N8. We don't normally associate N8 strains infecting humans. And then the daddy of them all. This was just terrible. This was the plague of the Spanish lady, the great influenza pandemic of 1918-1919. As the world was recovering from the First World War and all those people were killed in the First World War, in the closing stages of that war, American soldiers were being shipped over from a fort in the United States to France, and they were carrying with it this virus. And when they arrived in the early spring of 1918, it spread like wildfire. But people who got sick, it came to England early in that spring, and people who got infected, they got sick, but just a little bit sick, much like we got sick with the current H1N1. Most people had a very benign outcome, and that was exactly the same in 1918. And then it quieted down, and in the autumn it came back with a vengeance. And when it came back, it circulated around the world, infecting a third of the world's population, making sick hundreds of millions, and killing over 100 million people. It's the worst a pandemic ever experienced by our species. So that was H1N1. That, by the way, H1N1 came as a result of a bird, probably a chicken, directly infecting a human being. So it wasn't a reassorted virus. It was a direct zoonotic transfer. H2N2 appeared on the scene, causing the Asian flu in 1957. Then the Hong Kong flu came in 1968. Each of those globally killed about a million each. And then there was a quiescence. You'll notice, by the way, that H1N1 disappeared from circulation here. And then look what happened. It came back. The big story about how that came back. Big conspiracy story there, but a story for another day perhaps. And then here we have the situation today with the new H1N1. The V stands for variant, by the way, a new variant. Well, I'll come back to that in a minute. Sometimes called swine flu or swine influenza virus is not. It contains two. The current H1N1 variant contains two genes that we normally find in swine. It contains an avian gene and it contains a human gene. It's not transmitted from pigs to man and man to pigs. It is transmitted from people to people. On top of all that, we had just flying over here. I'll just do this again. On top of all that happening, we had the avian influenza viruses that have appeared, and the one we're most concerned about is H5N1. This is what happened, of course, in the early months of 2009. This is very deja vu. The early months of 2009, again in the States, in Canada, and in Mexico, a novel variant, H1N1, was identified. It swept across the world within months, and in June it was declared a global pandemic. The new strain has a genetic composition we've not seen previously, so nobody has any immunity to it. The first wave of the pandemic is now completed, and the second wave of the pandemic has probably now started in this country. I'm not going to go through this in any great detail, but the UK government planning assumptions are really quite telling. This is a slight downgrade of what the original planning assumptions were based on our experience of the first wave, but they're still deathly. I mean, just look at the number of the population that are going to become ill when they become infected, the clinical attack rate, one out of every three people in this country. Many of those people most of those people will have a benign course, but about 15% of those people will have complications. And many of those complications will end up in hospitals, and many of the people who end up in hospitals will require intensive care. And it begs the question, do we have that kind of facility available for that? I also point to the bottom part here, and that is 12% of the workforce. And I see the amber light. Okay, and then just going on, how it's transmitted. It's transmitted by breath, by droplets, and by contact transmission. It's not transmitted, except in special circumstances, by aerosol transmission. The prevention is the vaccine. The vaccine is going to be available in just a couple weeks. It is perfectly safe. Just as the seasonal vaccine is perfectly safe, the one of the safest vaccines in the world. We've given billions of doses over the years with minimal adverse effects. So we want frontline and social care workers to be encouraged to have the vaccine because they're at risk of becoming infected because of your very young age group and also because of your contact with patients, and then you are able to infect vulnerable patients. And also if you're ill, you weaken the service. So the point of excellence we're looking for here is an increased uptake of the pandemic. So just a couple reflections here. Irregular occurrence of pandemic diseases are a feature of human life. They'll always be here. We'll never get away from pandemics. The only way we can protect ourselves is through quality preparedness strategies, which are very effective, and then as individual practitioners, striving for excellence, increasing the quality of our care on a day-by-day basis. Excellence is not accidental. It is achieved one moment at a time, one step at a time. Our society is aware that excellence needs to be continuously and vigorously pursued in order that the most reliable research evidence of effectiveness informs everyday clinical practice. And this necessary reliance on good quality evidence requires investments in developing and promoting the research capacity and capability of our members in order for new points of excellence to be identified and for the heroes and heroines of tomorrow to emerge and carry forward the mission of our society. Therefore, on this 50th anniversary of the appointment of Sister Cottrell as the first infection control nurse in England, I'm delighted to have been asked to end this presentation by launching the Society's annual research awards, which will provide the principal structure our society will use to encourage curiosity, investigation, discovery, and the incorporation of new evidence into everyday infection prevention practice. The background to these awards was the development and publication of the Society's research strategy 2 years ago, which focused on fostering a research-intensive society. As a component of strategy implementation, colleagues in the Society's Research and Development Committee recently undertook an exercise to systematically elicit from members what they felt were the most important research issues facing infection prevention practitioners today. And during a mapping exercise, responses were analyzed and prioritized and grouped into themes, with the top two themes selected for initial research exploitation. And they are human behavior and infection prevention interventions. And more information on these are available here in the conference. Further information is available from our journal and also a conference poster, and Heather Loveday is here throughout. I just want to mention what the awards are. The Individual Postdoctoral Awards, £3,000 per annum for 2 years. Collaborative Small Project Awards for teams of five researchers or less, £5,000 per year. And Novice Investigator Awards to do master and doctoral research, £1,000 per annum for 3 years. There's the further sources of information. I just really want to end by wishing you all good luck and safe practice with the challenges that the second wave of the influenza pandemic may bring, and also to thank you for your kind attention this morning. Thank you, colleagues.